Welcome to Military History Inside Out, a podcast about military history throughout the ages. In today's episode, I speak with author Ted Edwards about a book he wrote, World War II History, Naval Aviation History, about a fighter ace, Stanley, callsign Swede, Vitasa, who is well known for his exploits at the Battle of Santa Cruz and for other things he did, other aviation exploits, fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. We talk about some of his life, some of Swede's life, a little bit about a deadly patrol mission the night before the Battle of Santa Cruz, which Ted Edwards dubbed the Phantom Goose Chase, I believe. Very interesting story, which I'm not sure if you'll hear about it anywhere else or you'll read about it in the book if you get the book, Seven at Santa Cruz. And then we talk a little bit about how he got the book published and that sort of thing. So definitely a great military history talk, and especially if you like World War II, and especially the Pacific War and Naval Aviation, you'll really enjoy this conversation. All right, well, thank you. I'm speaking with Ted Edwards, author of Seven at Santa Cruz. Thank you for speaking with me.
That's a pleasure to be involved with your discussion here.
So tell me about your background in writing and in history.
All right. As a kid, I grew up in a little community 50 miles north of New York City. And I was born in 1945, and so many of the people in this community were all veterans of one sort, whether Marine or sailors or airmen or Army. And I grew up in this community of all these guys with stories and experiences, and I was always vastly interested, even as a young kid. And I loved their can-do attitude when things needed to get done in our little community. It was quite a good introduction to veterans and their can-do attitude. And my ears were always eager to their stories. And that was the start of it without any formality. When I got to high school, whenever I was given an opportunity to read something for a book report, I oftentimes went to military history for reasons that I had no idea. It just seemed to be a fascination. When I was 18, on my 18th birthday, all this got a different focus. My mother announced to me that Joe Edwards, the wonderful man who brought me up, was in fact a stepfather, and my father was a naval aviator. Well, that kind of tweaked my interest in focusing World War II history down more into the Pacific War and naval aviation. I took courses at Syracuse University, but wasn't majoring in history, and then I went back to graduate school in Stony Brook in Long Island, State University of New York in Stony Brook, where I pursued a master's in history, and then I got what they call an ABD, all but dissertation, toward getting the PhD. I was inspired, and I'm grateful for the tutelage of Professor John Williams at Stony Brook, who ran a wonderful course on British Empire history that taught me a lot about how to investigate and write history. I've also been very fortunate in my life to have been connected with a fellow by the name of Angus Cameron, who back in the 50s and 60s was working for Alfred A. Knopf, and he became at some point executive vice president and senior literary editor, and he always encouraged me to take up journaling, which is different from a diary. Journaling is something I keep track of if I was doing something out of the ordinary. And I took that habit forward, and I've been a mountaineer, and so I've always taken a journal there. I've been involved with the international gymnastics business for a long time, and so I had the privilege of going to Pan American Games and Olympic Games. So I always took journals there. So writing got developed with all that practice and application. The writing has been a passion, and I encourage people to write journals as well.
Now, have you wanted to write this book for a while? Tell me about the genesis for this
All
one.
Right. Actually, this goes back to Watsonville fly-in. It was about 2007 or something like this. I went there and I had misinformation about my father. I thought he'd been aboard the Enterprise during World War II. And at the Watsonville fly-in, I was introduced to a man who had served aboard the Enterprise, Robbie Robinson, who was a dive bomber pilot, Air Group 10, in the Battle of Santa Cruz and beyond. And so we hit it up, and it turns out he didn't know my father, but after phone calls and so forth, we got friendly, and I go over there to his place, his assisted living place, and he'd tell me his stories. And finally, one day he said, looked at me and said, "Well, Ted, where's this going?" Well, I said, "Let's write a book." So we got together more frequently, and I investigated more of his history beyond just the military stuff. And he was a highly decorated pilot. And so we, in a couple of years, we put together a book. And when he turned 90, his family members from around the country flew in, and we had this little family biography ready to hand out to people, and he's signing and all this kind of thing. So it was kind of a nice occasion. "Ted, you need to get a hold of Sweet Vedasa." I go, "Sweet Vedasa? Well, I've read a lot of stuff, but I wasn't sure who that was." So I said, "Okay," and he gave me the phone number. So I call up Sweet out of the blue, and he's very courteous over the phone and whatnot. We get talking, he's telling me this and that, and nothing too detailed.
Mm-hmm.
But then we started having more in-depth conversations lasting quite a while. Finally, he said, "Ted, why don't you come on down, visit me in my home in Escondido, and you can interview me here." I said, "Sweet, that'd be great." So I, in the meantime, before I was going to make that trip, I figured I better find out some more about who this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing the homework, and I realized, my Lord, this guy has written up in every account of the Battle of Santa Cruz. And interesting thing was, none of those accounts seem to jive with each other.
Hmm.
So, whatever, I tried to cobble together a 10-page piece on what I thought happened during his famous mission, where he shot down, officially 7 down and 1 probable, but he knew it was 8 down. So I cobble this thing together, and I get down there the first day of the interview. We're going to have 2 days, and he gives me like 5 hours the first day, and he's 96 years old at this juncture, and still sharp as a tack. So I said at the end of our day, when we only covered his first half of his career, I said, and hadn't got to the Battle of Santa Cruz, I said, "Hey, Sweet, would you mind reading this over tonight and let me know what you think tomorrow?" "Sure, no problem." So I go back the next day. "Well, Sweet, what'd you think?" "Ted, this is all wrong. It's just filled with errors." I go, "Oh, God." I figured, how long is he going to put up with me? So I said, he softened it. He says, "Ted, you get all this out of books?" I said, "Yeah." he says, "If your sources are wrong, how can you get it right?" "I know, of course, because I was there." So I said, "Okay, Sweet." I turned on the recorder. I said, "Tell me how it went." And so my first idea was working with Sweet was just to get clarity on this Battle of Santa Cruz. And then it turned into something much larger as events bore out.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't plan to do it when I got into this thing. I was just kind of interested in finding out, well, what is Sweet about? What was this mission all about that it gets written up everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
So it has taken me 8 years to assemble all this.
So,
quite a project.
Yeah. So the title is 7 at Santa Cruz, but the book is described as being about his life. So, obviously his life is more than the Battle of Santa Cruz. So tell me what the main focus is, of the book.
Well, let me just amend the title, 7 at Santa Cruz, is followed by a comma and the life of fighter ace Stanley Sweet Vedasa. So that explains the fact that it is in fact a biography.
Mm-hmm.
But what it's about? Well, John Lundstrom, in his early books, talked about the A-Team. Well, the A-Team is the first group of naval aviators confronting the Japanese following Pearl Harbor and so forth. And so He turned out to be a great hero in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and as well in the Battle of Santa Cruz. So I call him the A-team's high performer.
Mm-hmm.
The book is focuses really a lot on leadership failures, those primarily by Admiral Thomas Kincaid.
Mm-hmm.
It also addresses the historical disunity I just talked about in terms of no two accounts of Swede's famous mission jive with each other, or in the event with Swede's account. And then thirdly, there's a lot of Medal of Honor politics that evolved from this.
Mm-hmm.
And the book traces, follows the development of naval aviation. It's a pretty serious dissection of the Battle of Santa Cruz, and it comes with a moral of the limitations of records. What I've come to discover is that while records may verify, they are seldom the arbiters of truth. Those who write those records have things to either defend or protect. So it's been an interesting process. When I realized that none of these accounts of Swede's mission made any sense either to Swede or to each other, I went to the National Archives in Maryland, and there I was able to find Jimmy Flatley's after-action report following the Battle of Santa Cruz, and I copied the whole thing, and in it there are after-action reports from several of the Air Group 10 pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So when I looked at that, I realized, and then there's a long one, several pages in Swede's name, and it has all the elements that were cherry-picked by the historians who did, in my view, due diligence. They tracked down the action report. This, when I showed this to Swede, he said, "I never wrote that report. I never signed off on that report," which is true. There's no signature on it.
Hmm.
The mystery of disunity was replaced by the mystery of who wrote the report. But Swede affirmed vehemently that he did not write that report, and it did not reflect what he did in that mission. So one of the big tasks in an appendix is to take apart, to look at each of those historical accounts, see how they've jived with this bogus after-action report,
mm-hmm.
and then to distinguish that from what Swede told me had happened.
Interesting. So as far as his life then, does it go back to, I guess, when he was a child, or back to when he first, college and started training as a pilot?
It's interesting. He wrote himself a pretty good little journal. And then he goes back to the era of the barnstormers, which he capitalized. And he talked about these guys coming in, landing on maybe a farmer's field or something, and getting out of the plane, pushing the leather cap back, stepping away from the plane and lighting up the cigarette, daring do mustache, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he was pretty taken by that. And then he was in college, and there were different people coming by in uniform to try and get people to sign up. And he wound up going into the Naval Aviation Cadet program. But and when he was working summers out in Idaho, building trails and all this kind of thing. So it's been a consistent interest of his. And of course, he became a great aviator. Whitey Fighter called him a pure flyer.
Mm-hmm. So, why do you think he chose the Navy over the U.S. Army Air Corps?
I think it was a Marine came all spiffed up, and Swede rushed up to him and wanted to ask him a bunch of questions and so forth, and was kind of impressed by all of that, and he decided he was going to jump that way.
Hmm. I guess, tell me, do you touch upon, or did he talk about his feelings when Pearl Harbor occurred? I know the U.S. was sort of thinking they were going to end up in the war, but did he have an impression?
Well, he was in the Atlantic on the Yorktown, and they were running kind of escort duty on convoys and so forth. And in Virginia when they got word of Pearl Harbor being bombed. And then Yorktown was then rushed back out to the Pacific, and then they made a delivery of some troops, I forget where just now, and after that they made some raids on these outlying Japanese outposts, and then came back into Pearl Harbor a month later, and his reflection was, my God, it looked like it could have happened last week or yesterday. Everything was still devastated, oil on the water, you know, and one of the details that surprised me was he said that one of these airports, they still had to sweep the shell casings off the runways in order to get the things back ready for use. So the devastation was widespread and long-lasting. But he was profoundly affected by it.
So I noticed in his some biographical information I read that he started out as a bomber, and I guess he had he shot down a bunch of the enemy, and they switched him to fighters. Is that correct?
That's correct. When he was on New Yorktown, he was part of the scouting squadron, which flies dive bombers, SBDs, Dauntlesses. And it's a two-seater plane. You got a backseat man manning a couple of twin machine guns. And in the Battle of Coral, before the Battle of Coral Sea, he had been an expert dive bomber. Had been responsible for the destruction of several modest Japanese ships and supplies and so forth. And then when the Coral Sea erupted, he, on the first day of the battle, contributed one of his bombs to the destruction of the Shoho. That was a Japanese aircraft carrier that was the first Japanese aircraft carrier to be sunk in an avalanche of ordnance. It was one of these raids where it seemed like every bomber hit and every torpedo hit. The thing went under. From the time Swede showed up with Bill Birch's squadron, it was something like, I don't know, 7 minutes before that ship plowed under. It was just crazy fast. And the next day, in another one of those admiral's decisions that were highly disputed, they were ordered. Swede was ordered to fly a CAP, Combat Air Patrol, in front of the carriers, and the thinking was they would intercept the slow flying Cape Japanese torpedo bombers that might be coming in low. Well, there were a lot of things wrong with that. First of all, the Japanese escort Zeros swooped down on those CAP bombers and shot down a bunch of them real fast. Like four of them went down really quickly. And turns out, too, that the Capes were much faster than anybody expected. So it was a disaster. But in that battle, Swede outgunned three Japanese Zeros that were attacking him. Zero, of course, is far more agile plane than the dive bombers that Swede was flying. But Swede had been well tutored by Bill Birch, his old squadron commander, who they encouraged people to jump them anytime. Get me in a dogfight anytime. I want to figure out, surprise me. I want to figure, what am I going to do? How am I going to react? How are we going to, and then we analyze everything. So at one point, Swede said, I don't think there was anything about dogfighting that I didn't know. So he got real tested, and three Japanese fighters. It's unclear, the Japanese records say they indicate that they may have gotten back. It's unclear if they were shot down. Swede was given credit for downing those, but the main thing is that they did not shoot him down. He outflew three, you know, highly experienced Japanese pilots in planes that were clearly superior to what Swede was flying. Howell Buell, a famous dive bomber pilot himself, opined that he thought Swede should have earned the Medal of Honor for that act alone.
So, did you say that the bomber that he was in had a pilot and a gunner, or it was just one?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's a pilot and a gunner, yeah.
So he was the pilot, I guess, and he was with a gunner?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Now, did he say, or what do you think, where did his ability come from? Was he just well-trained as everyone else in right place at the right time, or did he have something special skill-wise or whatnot?
It seems that he had something special on this thing, Chris. He goes, that's all the training and so forth. And as I say, for a dive bomber to outfly three Japanese Zeros is pretty crazy. And then in the summer of 42, he joined Jimmy Flatley's Grim Reapers, in transitioning to F-4F Wildcats. And that's what he was flying when the Battle of Santa Cruz came upon.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, I guess, that to imagine someone just switching from being a bomber pilot to a fighter pilot nowadays seems like you need quite a bit of training to make that switch, and it seems like he did it pretty quickly. You said he already knew dogfighting pretty well.
Yeah, you might say seamlessly, and Jimmy Flatley felt that Sweden was a huge asset to that squadron that Flatley was trying to organize. Sweden brought in an experience and maturity. And so when he began flying the Wildcat, well, that just freed him up to be even a better flyer.
Mm-hmm. And that was a single, was just one crew, one pilot? And
single seat. Yep.
Single seat. Yeah. So tell me about, I don't want to reveal too much what's in the book, but can you give me some tidbits about the Battle of Santa Cruz?
The more important thing might be the day before the Battle of Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And that was what I have labeled the Phantom Goose Chase. The Enterprise had been ordered out to the Pacific to join Hornet already there off Guadalcanal. Now, the Enterprise had just assembled this air group, but they had no time to integrate their exercisers. It was a fledgling group, no experience. So they were sent out there to join up with Hornet to confront a huge Japanese task force headed toward Guadalcanal in their hopes to finally retake the island and get rid of the Marines and Henderson Field and the Cactus Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So Kincaid was involved in the Battle of the Eastern Solomons, and that was in August, late August. So now we are almost 2 months later, and Kincaid, at the time in Eastern Solomons, had been aboard Enterprise, but he was not ahead of that task force, so he was impotent. And Enterprise in the Eastern Solomons got hammered pretty badly, and Kincaid and his staff got thrown around. Nobody got hurt, but it scared the hell out of him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was suffering PTSD following that attack. So now he goes into the Battle of Santa Cruz. He's, for the first time in his career, task force commander for the two carriers, which shocked Sweden when he heard about it, because he was not, Kincaid was not an aviator.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Halsey gets word that the Japanese force is headed toward them, and he sends off this incendiary thing, strike, repeat, strike. Well, Kincaid, he's 360 miles away from the Japanese. When he joins Hornet, Hornet has been in the area for some time as a very experienced air group, and so when Enterprise arrives on the scene, they wisely instruct Kincaid to be the duty carrier. Now, duty carrier means your job is to do two things. First of all, to send out a fan of searchers, which he did. And then the second thing you do is provide CAP, combat air patrol. That means protection over the task force.
Mm-hmm.
So your air group is tied up with those two things. And then on Hornet, they had a full strike spotted on board, ready to go if anything should develop. Well, Kincaid gets a twist in his knickers, and I think he gets all flustered, I think. He establishes his cap, and then he's got, it's late in the afternoon, and then he decides to cobble together a 20-plane Strike Force. Sweet is now given, he's the head of 8 Wildcat escort fighters. Then there's 5 dive bombers and something like 7 torpedo bombers. The remainder of basically Kincaid's task force. Well, Kincaid's staff goes down to the ready room to present this. Sweet looks down, you hear 360 miles. He says, wait, we can't get there, it's too far. And they just refuse to concede. So, off they go. And Sweet, well, before that, Sweet throws down his clipboard and said, the Admiral is an ass in earshot of its staff. So, you know, this is mutinous.
Yeah.
Or whatever. They send him out. And so Sweet's the head of the, as I say, the head of the escort, 8 fighters. So, an hour after they leave, Kincaid gets word that an American snooper patrol plane has spooked the Japanese into a turn farther north, completely making it impossible to have any contact. And even armed with that information, he refuses to wire or to radio his people and call them back. That was a fateful error. So the mini task force strike group flies about 175 miles or whatever. It's a beautiful, clear afternoon. See nothing, of course. Kincaid knows this. Then Jim Thomas, head of the dive bomber squadron, he's the head of the whole group, you know, in terms of navigating and whatnot. So he bends another search leg. It's starting to get late. And nothing out that way either, and clear as a bell. He starts to bend another leg, and Sweet gets over him and burps his guns and says, we got to get out of here. We got to go home. Sun's going down, gas is going down, and nobody is qualified for night landing.
Wow.
So they begin back going back to a place called Point Option. Point Option is where the carrier is expected to be upon their return. So now it's late in the afternoon, dusk is setting, and it's getting darker. And as they fly toward Point Option, inexplicably, one of the fighter pilots climbs out of his aircraft and parachutes into the sea. Then, mystifying everyone. Well, then they soon get to Point Option, and by now the Merc is down low. They're flying very, very low to stay out of the cloud. They're terrified of collisions. And it's getting, and it's dark. They get to Point Option, nobody home, nobody there. Kincaid had abandoned them. So, what to do? Everything goes crazy. Well, any organization, everybody starts milling around. They're all fiddling with the YZB sets, trying to get the homing signal that they should be hearing. That's not on. Well, two of the dive bombers are flying low now, under the Merc. They drop their bombs. Two bombs explode, perforate two of the dive bombers. They eventually have to ditch. What to do? Swede doesn't know what to do. Then he remembers, oh, yeah, I was flying CAT this morning over the Enterprise, and I noticed there was leaking oil. Now, we're in the dark. He's going to look for an oil slick on a black ocean. He turns on his lights. Whitey Feitner, flying wing on him, turns on his lights. And lo and behold, he finds the oil slick and begins following it back, and is greatly relieved to find that it's narrowing. So he's at least got the right direction.
Right.
All right. Now they fly about 50 miles, and then finally they see the deck. There's the Enterprise. So Sweet goes to land first, and one of the fellow fighters, the new guy, he lands simultaneously with Sweet. Damn near kills Sweet by chewing up his airplane with his prop. They get them out of the way. So you got 7 fighters returning out of the 8. Now the dive bombers are next to come in, and they're real shy of gas. Well, 2 have already been lost. So the first guy lands, he's fine. The second guy lands, he's fine. Third guy comes in, disregards a wave off, crashes his aircraft, and then destroys another one of the bombers already landed.
Yeah, boy.
So now they got 4 bombers. With the resulting mess on the deck, 3 of the torpedo bombers face fuel exhaustion and have to ditch. So now this mission that shouldn't have had to happen has cost 4 dive bombers, 3 torpedo bombers, one fighter, a pilot, and a crew member. All for nothing. No shots fired, and for something that Sweden knew from the start was going to go terribly wrong.
Wow.
So that's the Stanton goose chase, and it's and if that, in a nutshell, is why Swede did not get the Medal of Honor he so richly deserved for his interception the next day, which arguably saved Kincaid's butt in the process.
Mm-hmm. Imagine if none of them had returned, if he hadn't found that oil slick, and there you have a carrier without any aircraft.
Well, I mean, don't forget, they had the aircraft and the searchers and the but who was in this group that they sent out? First of all, you had the commander of the whole air group. You had the skipper of the dive bomber squadron. You had the executive officer of the torpedo squadron. And you had Swede in front of the fighters. And without Swede's action the next day, there's a good chance that the Enterprise would have been sunk, because he took out 6 torpedo bombers and 2 dive bombers.
Yeah.
Kincaid had gambled with his own survival.
Hmm. This is kind of an aside, but as far as the pilot who parachuted, did the dive bombers that you know, got perforated, you know, by their own bombs, were they able to get out?
Good question. One of the things that the Navy was good about was rescuing downed airmen.
Mm-hmm.
So the pilot that parachuted out of the fighter, he was never seen again. And then when one of those torpedo bombers went in the drink, one of the crew members could not get out and went down with his plane.
Mm-hmm.
But the other crew, pilots and crew, were rescued. But nobody aboard the Enterprise that night knew of this.
Mm-hmm.
So the morale, of course, was just an absolute mess.
Hmm.
And early that morning, just to compound the whole day, that morning, as they just arrived on station before any of this goose chase thing, Bill Blair found his propeller in high pitch, tried to make a landing, bounced over the barriers, and wound up destroying a total of 5 planes. No one killed. But here, so now we have 13 planes out of Kincaid's inventory, and then a crewman and a pilot gone. All this before any shots are fired.
Wow. A story like that makes you wonder how the Navy succeeded when it did. But,
because the guys like Swede, that's how.
Yeah, exactly. The guys who made the most of what was left.
Right? All night long after that Phantom goose chase, all night long he was trying to assemble, well, what are we going to fight with tomorrow? This Swede says the Admiral Staff had no clue.
Mm-hmm.
So he was up most of the night trying to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to unify this air group, da 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 da.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I noted that after all his successes, though, they made him an instructor after that, at some point after.
Well, one of the he stayed in theater until the following spring. But one of the things that separates the U.S. Navy from the Japanese Imperial Navy was that we would rotate our successful pilots out of theater to have them train the up-and-coming guys.
Mm-hmm.
Japan, on the other hand, insisted on keeping those aviators out there until they perished.
Mm-hmm.
So once that air group was gutted, then they didn't have the quality of people coming out to replace them.
Yeah. So what was Swede's, when he was relaying this information to you, what sort of attitude or bearing did he have? Was he bemused or excited, or what was his general attitude?
Well, you know, when he talked about the Phantom goose chase and Kincaid, until the day he died, it was his belief that Kincaid was guilty of criminal negligence. So he still got hot under the collar, and so too did Whitey Feitner. I interviewed him a few times as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes Sweet could get a glint in his eye when he was talking about aerial combat. So,
mm-hmm.
And this is it, you know, I knew him from the age of 96 and 98.
So would you say that after he was done with his combat flying, did he seem at all disappointed that he wasn't flying anymore, that he was an instructor, and then I guess he became a CO and, you know, shore and sea?
That's a good question, Chris. Yeah, he was. You know, in his concluding remarks, you know, he said, I just wish I could have been in there more. You know, that he did feel denied in a certain way. And you got to wonder, too, a guy, I mean, for a while, he was Navy's top ace.
Mm-hmm.
And what more he could have done out there. And, you know, as the war went on, too, the Japanese superiority in aircraft was, you know, waning because of advances in our aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Hellcat coming out and so forth. And a lot of the pilots that flew in those subsequent battles in 44 and 45 felt that the Japanese aviators, the quality of those had atrophied.
Mm-hmm.
Although anyone knew that even a mediocre Japanese pilot could have his best day while you had your worst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did he like being an instructor?
Yeah, and I think what I learned about the Swede was that he related to people in a really grounded, honest, forthright, straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at people in the photographs with him, and you can tell that there's this great respect and admiration. And of course, all these young guys wanted to know what anything they could, learn anything they could from Swede.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the guys above Swede, he didn't brook the attitudes of superiors that didn't know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they didn't like him because he spoke truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any tolerance for, you know, pussyfooting around or trying to sugarcoat stuff.
So I can see why someone like that, I can understand why they don't make admiral, because you're not political enough. But in a sense, I'm surprised he even made captain if he had that, you know, if he was willing to go out there on a limb.
Yeah, well, and you know, when he was captain, he did a billet as CO of the USS Constellation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most interesting timing because he got that assignment right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And now he's taken this huge supercarrier on the first Westpac tour over, you know, along Japan and China and so forth. And he met with Chiang Kai-shek. I have pictures of the two of them meeting in Swede's captain's quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then he gets back from that tour just after Kennedy is killed. But during that tour, there was an accident where they hadn't, what do you call it, checked one of the trap lines for landing, for catching the hook, tail hook.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane blew right through it, went off the carrier into the water, and took the pilot and the crewman. So those kinds of things, you know, look bad on your record, I suppose.
Right.
And Swede said, you know, hey, it comes down to responsibility. I'm the bottom line.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I didn't mean to insinuate that he didn't have the skill to be captain. I was just pointing out that sometimes when you're outspoken in the military, you know, that also works against you getting promoted and whatnot.
Absolutely. No, I'm right there with you on that. But, you know, it's a good day and a lot of things. You know, he was also tasked in the spring of 43 with trying to land the Corsair aboard the Enterprise. And in its initial stages, the Corsair was a very cumbersome aircraft and had a lot of problems, especially around landing on carriers.
Hmm.
Well, so Swede landed the thing a number of times according to this whole protocol that they had sent, and eventually downed it. Said, no, this is not good for carrier operations at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it had bad brakes. He had to skid to even see the landing signal officer. The machine guns might fire without anybody pulling the trigger.
Oh.
it was crazy stuff. So he downed it and figured that that probably was a black mark on his record, too.
Hmm. So I want to talk about the resources you used for your research. You mentioned some of the interviews and documents, and it also sounded like you were able to use some Japanese documents as well.
Actually, no, I haven't used any Japanese documents. What I do is, I mean, I've gone to John Lundstrom, and he has perused those things, and some of my information about the Japanese stuff comes through him.
Mm-hmm.
As far as resources, well, Swede, of course, I interviewed him in person on three different days. The last time was on the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Santa Cruz. That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But he in turn put me in touch with Whitey Feitner, and I had contacted Hal Buell on my own, and I talked to Butch Boris before he passed. So I had a lot of stuff, you know, from first person stuff. Then I went to the National Archives in Maryland twice to try to understand that historical disunity I was talking about earlier, you know, where none of these accounts of Swede's mission add up or duplicate.
Right.
And so that's when I got Flatley's report and went through that with Swede. Then we wrote up the Swede's mission the way he described it. And in the summer of 2012, we got that mission correctly portrayed in the Naval Aviation News.
Hmm.
And so, for the first time at age 98, Swede could read the correct version of his mission. So I brought down a copy of it, and I said, "Hey, Swede, you mind to sign this for me?" And he's got this, you know, little squiggly handwriting of a guy of 98 years. And he says, to Ted, with highest regards, Swede Batesa, and a date, which I, of course, treasure.
Yeah, that's cool. So I think I was going to say, I think the Navy has a pile of reports they need corrected that maybe you can get to after, now that you've done this one.
Well, this is a revisionist history. Okay, I've taken all the histories of this thing to task.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a close-up look at the Battle of Santa Cruz. I really got a lot of different viewpoints and so forth, and I feel like it makes an understanding of that very complicated battle very accessible.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that piece. Also, I want to throw in there that I had been twice visited the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, which is a great resource and a terrific museum.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I read every book on the topic.
Yeah, I think the what you found researching this just kind of makes me scared about how much history out there is, I don't want to say inaccurate, but just, well, I guess it is inaccurate, or, you know, not wholly accurate.
Well, you know about that grain of salt.
Oh, yes, exactly.
So, yeah, it was a real shake-up to me to realize, you know, wow, all these guys did the right thing, went after that after-action report, and then that turns out to be bogus. Well, who would ever have suspected that? And I figured that's where a lot of guys didn't go to Swede personally. Well, we got his report, you know, the numbers of airplanes down is right, so why bother the man?
Right. Plus, you know, they always want to wrap up work and get out of there and hit the bars or whatever, so.
Well, I could talk to them there, too.
Yeah. So you did mention, well, what part of the research did you find most enjoyable? You mentioned one thing, but anything else?
I would talk with Swede, and we had hundreds of hours on the phone. I mean, just amazing. He said, call me anytime. Well, I would ask Swede, well, who is your commander, or who is the admiral, or when did this happen, or what ship? He always knew. And if he didn't right away, he'd say, wait a minute, it'll come to me. And, of course, 5 minutes later, we're talking about something else. And he'd go, oh, yeah, by the way, Jim Caldwell, whatever. And I checked this stuff out, and it was always right.
Wow.
And it was just amazing. Yeah, so that was the funnest part of it, just dealing with Swede and all the different little things he'd turn me on to. He'd mention a name while I go, you know, look up that person. What was that person doing? One of the neat people that Swede turned me on to was Joe Stapp. And Joe Stapp was doing research on how to do strapping for pilots now that they're ejecting from these jet planes and experiencing these high deceleration forces, G-forces.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an old track that they used to use for figuring out V1 buzz bombs, how those things worked that the Germans were firing in Europe. And they straightened that out, made it an acceleration-deceleration track. And Stapp would never ask anyone to do something without first doing it himself. And these things, the acceleration was unbelievable, G-forces, up to 600 miles per hour or something in some, I forget how many seconds, it's nuts. Mm-hmm. And then they stopped that thing from 600 and some odd miles per hour in less than 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's enormous G-forces.
Right.
So Stapp was dubbed the fastest man on Earth because he's flying on his sled.
Yeah.
And so Swede was offered a ride one time by Stapp. Swede politely declined because Stapp got beat up bad. He broke a collarbone one time, wrist, bloodshot eyes, all kinds of little minor and less minor insults to himself.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring him up was after Joe Stapp got his great celebrity from all this, he was on the picture of, I don't know, Time or whatever, the fastest human or whatever. He turned that celebrity into laws insisting that automobiles be equipped with seatbelts.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, Joe Stapp.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's just one of those little sidebar stories. It's he threw out a name, I followed up. Whoa, what's this? This needs to be told.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you mentioned some of the stuff you were surprised by in your research. Was there anything else you haven't mentioned yet that surprised you?
No, it's just that whole business of, what do records mean and where does the truth lie? And especially in these times of fake news, it's easy to be a cynic. But I don't know. I'm doing this investigation has kind of made me wary, but also I realize, hey, you can get the truth, but kind of stick with it.
Right. So what would you say is the most difficult part of the research? Any mysteries that were difficult to track down?
Not so much. Just, the real mysteries is sometimes how to best use the National Archives. Because it's so much stuff to go through and how to wean it down and so forth. But, I don't know, in retrospect, it seems sort of straightforward, and Swede got me going on a good solid path before he passed.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that emotionally moved you in your research?
Well, one of the neat things that did happen when that article came out in Naval Aviation News in 2012, and Swede got a bunch of copies, and he had a bunch of folks that read that, and this is, Swede's still around. So they started visiting him, calling him up, and he had, at that point he had helped to put him in the hospital on and off, and it enabled him to get visits and attention and old buddies dropping by. So in terms of heartwarming, that's kind of the best part for me.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's really nice. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published, if there were any?
Well, 8 years is a pretty good difficulty in its own right. But the number of edits, I think once Naval Institute Press contracted me, they realized, they told me that they think you have something special here, and they put top people onto it, and just the constant editing, you think you've had a bunch of edits already, and you think it's tight and squeaky clean, and, then the copy editor comes in, and now I've got a whole bunch of red and yellow all over the thing coming back at me. And then that that's not done, I think we get done, and then it's on to copy edit, or the page proofs, and a whole long list of queries.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have imagined so many things would come up, but these people really were sharp-eyed and helped me avoid some goofy little errors that I'm really grateful for.
So
where... I feel like this book is very, very tight now. It's a real good piece.
So where in the 8-year process did you know or have a pretty strong feeling that it would get published?
I didn't get offered a contract until it was 2016.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that was after a number of attempts, you know, and I got rejected at first, and then I took the manuscript out to Lynn Baca, who runs an outfit called Medea,
mm-hmm.
and she took a look at it and helped me out, you know, trying to form. There's a lot to do with how the Naval Institute Press wants their style to be and that kind of thing. Stuff that was unfamiliar to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a steep learning curve on that in that regard as well.
Mm-hmm. So what's your next writing project?
Well, you know, right now, over the years, I've collected a series of small, what I would call service biographies. That is to say, I'd interview these guys and get their stories, you know, what they do during the war and this kind of thing. Right now, I'm working with a guy named Frank Tozer, who served in a CBI, China Burma India Theater.
Mm-hmm.
He's 95 years old, still sharp as a tack, and we go out for breakfast or dinner once in a while. So I've done a piece on him, and then I have a neighbor, Art Fricky, who's also 95. He served aboard a troop transport, and then later on aboard a destroyer escort, which sank two German submarines in a matter of 4 hours.
Mm.
But I've got those are two of about five or six that I've gotten. I'm thinking maybe I'll just put together a book of these little incidents. None of these is worthy of a material for a biography.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I could just do a little shotgun book of here's service. You know, here's how people serve.
Mm-hmm.
Just to honor those vets. So
yeah.
We'll see. And then I write about mountaineering, and I write about Burning Man, and quite a variety of eclectic interest.
Do you have a web page that people can find your stuff on, or is it just the Amazon? And
you know, yeah, I think if you Amazon, there's a web page. I tell you what, Chris, I am such a I did this whole technology thing. I'm a country boy. I go out hiking in the woods almost every day. You know, the only time I want to see a screen is when I'm writing. Other than that, you know,
yeah.
And you heard me admit in the emails, you know, this whole Skype thing is new to me. Old guy disease, I guess.
So there's no web page then. It's just go to Amazon.
There is a web page, but I'm not just. Google my name, I guess, and see what pops up.
Okay.
I just don't follow it that much.
Okay, fair enough. So that's all I have. Any final thoughts or words?
I've been very fortunate to work with these guys, and they've taken me under their wings, you know. And you know, once I did the thing with Robbie, I feel like I got vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, Swede was eager to, you know, deal with me, because a lot of people have come down the pike asking Sweet about his story and stuff and all this, and then he puts me on to Whitey and this kind of thing. So I feel very fortunate, and having had the opportunity to talk with these guys, spend hours with them, and appreciate what they did for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. All right, well, thank you.
All right, well, Chris, it's been a treat talking with you.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez Warscholar, on YouTube under warscholar1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.